This is Classic Grain Hamcast number 25, posted August 9th, 2020. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. The most communicative bureaucrat Hap Holly, KC9RP, interviewed during his 30 years as founder and producer of his Rain Report was Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, special counsel for amateur radio enforcement with the Federal Communications Commission. This week we'll feature the first of two excerpts from a 2020 interview of Riley by Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, QSO Today podcast founder and producer.
Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, your host. Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, started his ham radio career in Rock Hill, South Carolina in the 1960s and proceeded to law school and to a career at the FCC, or Federal Communications Commission. Riley was part of the evolution of the FCC as it dealt with paging, cellular, PCS, and amateur radio. K4ZDH tells his amateur radio story, as well as his impact on the amateur radio service through his career at the FCC.
With me, it started with a little shortwave radio my uncle had. I think it was one of those bigger Zenith radios, and he would tune around the frequencies with me, and we'd hear some ham radio operators. And then I ended up getting a Nightkit Space Spanner radio kit for, I think, 1995, which I still have to this day. I'm looking at it now. And that was in 1960. And I built that and heard ham operators. And then one day he said, I know an amateur operator here in town. I'll take you over there to meet him sometime. My uncle didn't have a license himself, but he knew a couple of the ham operators. So he took me over to meet a fellow, and as it turns out, this fellow was Morris Hall in Rock Hill, South Carolina, and he had the Collins outfit from the 60s, and I don't know if that was they called them gray boxes or black boxes or whatever, but once you've seen a full Collins station like that with the big amplifier that was approximately the size of our refrigerator, you don't ever forget that. I immediately talked to him about getting a license. He took me to my first ham fest, which was in Shelby, North Carolina, at the state park there. Within a few months, I had my license. I was able to learn the code pretty fast thanks to his practice with me. And so I was a very active ham operator until college, and I got out of it for a couple of years, got back into it right before law school. When I got out of law school, I decided to come with the FCC. I had a chance to go to Columbia, South Carolina.
Don't tell the whole story because I have to ask you questions along the way, right?
Gotcha. All right. Great.
Okay. So you got your first license. Do you remember Morris Hall's call sign?
W4CX, I believe.
Would you say that he was your first Elmer?
Yeah. I had two or three Elmers all at the same time. They were really helpful. And I had Grady Horton, K4TZG. Was the main Elmer. I guess I learned most of my code from him.
Did you belong to any amateur radio clubs while you were a teenager?
No. I took the classes that a local club there had offered, but I wasn't a member of the club.
I think I read someplace that your first license was in 1961. What was your call sign?
KN4ZDH was the first call sign.
But there was a problem, wasn't there, when your father read the license?
Yeah, I was working at a little country store and gas station, and my license actually was dated July 20th, 1960. That's when I first got my novice license. Anyway, my dad calls me at the store and said, your license came, and it says novice. And I said, what's the call sign? And so in those days, they were manually typed. And the way this was typed on the line for the call sign, the Z, and ZDH was a little bit too low, and it looked like a 7. So he said, it's KN47DH. And I'm thinking, oh, no, they've messed up my call sign. Now I won't be able to get on. I got to contact the FCC. But when I got home and looked at it, I could tell that it was KN4ZDH. My first contact that night was on 80 meters, and it was Earl Savage, a fellow in Richmond, Virginia. He took special pains to slow down, and we talked for quite a long time, and then I got a card from him. In 1999, when I got back into amateur radio big time, I located Earl Savage, and he still lived in Richmond, and he was in a nursing home, but still lucid, a retired teacher, and I should have done that given the amount of time that he spent with me. But I never forgot that first contact, and I think the old-time people like myself never forget the first contact. I don't know about newer licensees, because you can make thousands more contacts now than we could in those days with crystals and AM transmitters and so forth.
Do you remember your first rig?
First rig was a E.F. Johnson Challenger. I'm looking at it right now. I still have it. And a Hallicrafter SX-110 receiver. Now, that was the first rig that I had. Now, of course, some ham operators loaned me, I think it was a DX-60 or something like that, and a basic receiver. But the first rig that I got myself was the E.F. Johnson Challenger and the Hallicrafter SX-110.
And what's the current rig?
Current rig, I have a Yaesu FT920, and I have a Kenwood TS520. I did get the ICOM 7300 recently, which I used most of the time. I have some Drake equipment, a Drake 2NT and a 2C and a 2B. I always like the Drake equipment. When I traded the Challenger, I got a Valiant. And when I traded a Valiant, I got an HT37 and went on sideband, which I still have here.
So you have multiple operating positions, right, in your shack?
Yes, I do.
How did you divide them up?
Well, I have three different old desks. And on one desk, I have an amplifier in the FT920. The Yaesu FT920 was my favorite rig. I think they stopped making it too early. It was a rig ahead of its time. For example, it had the pulsing circuit to tune an amplifier and things like that, which only came out in the other rigs later on. And so on the, I have one vintage desk, which is the Drake tube rigs, the 2NT and the 2C, and the HT37. Now, a good friend of mine in South Carolina, who's 96, recently called, I guess last year, said, I got a Collins 7584 here that's been restored, and I'm trying to thin out my equipment. I don't know what's going to happen in the next few years, and so I'd like for you to come get this thing if you would. So with the HT37, I'm using a Collins 7584, which by coincidence was, or by chance, was refurbished by Howard Mills, the Collins restoration guy down in Harpers Ferry, West Virginia. So it's a beauty.
Did I see in a picture that you might have an S-line too?
No. At one time, I had an S-line, I guess 75 S3, maybe, I'm not sure, for a brief time. But S-line was something. I used to daydream in the Allied radio catalogs. It would show the Collins S-lines in there, and, of course, could never have afforded one. But the beam that I have a TA-33 beam, which I got from Allied Radio in 1961, and I got the TA-33 beam, 100 feet of coax, and 100 feet of rotor cable, and an AR-22 rotor that came with it for $125. But I'm still using the beam. It's out back, and I've had to replace, you know, the traps a couple of times. And I know there are probably better antennas, but I'm really attached to it, so I'll never take that thing down. That'll go down when I go down, I guess.
Now, in 1961, $130 was a month's salary for a lot of people.
That was a big price then, but when you look at what they cost now,
right,
particularly with cable and everything.
Almost a month's salary.
Yeah.
Did ham radio play a part in the choices that you made for your education and career?
Yeah, it did, really. Ham radio taught me that I did have an ability in technical things, a little bit anyway. I wasn't good at math. I think I would have been better at math had it been taught differently. Ham radio told me that I could do technical things, and I really enjoyed it. And so when I got out of law school, I wanted to go to the FCC. I had a choice of going to the FCC or going into law practice with my cousin down in South Carolina. But he told me one day, he said, you can start tomorrow if you want to, but I want to tell you, I do divorces, sewer easements, and taxes. And he said, if you think you'll be fascinated by that, you can start tomorrow. And I said, well, I think I'll go to the FCC for a couple of years and see how that is. And so I planned to stay 3 years, and every year I liked it better and better. So I ended up retiring from the FCC. And, of course, the highlight of that, well, I had some very good periods there. The explosion and cellular and land mobile radio was interesting, the cable TV area. But my favorite part was when I got to restart the amateur radio enforcement program, which had been dormant for 12 years.
You're in the middle of our first excerpt from a 2020 virtual conversation with Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, FCC Special Counsel for Amateur Radio Enforcement, conducted in 2020 by Eric Guth, 4Z1UG, for his QSO Today podcast. We'll conclude this excerpt after a short break for station identification. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Classic Rain from www.therainreport.com.
It's my understanding, though, in the mid-70s, you were a Nader's Raider. What made you a Nader's Raider, and what did you do there?
Well, I was interested in it because he was they were studying bisonosis, or it's called brown lung disease, in textile mills in the Carolinas. And I had read about it. My grandfather worked for the Victoria textile mill in Rock Hill, South Carolina, and he came home every day covered with cotton dust. But we grew up in a textile era, and I think Rock Hill, South Carolina had about five or six mills at the time, all cotton mills. And so I just wrote a letter to Nader.
Ralph Nader you're referring to, right?
Yes.
Who was a big consumer advocate in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was a big deal. The Nader's Raiders were a big deal. So I wrote him and got a letter back from somebody in the office there saying, coincidentally, we want to look at all the textile mills in the Carolinas. If you're willing to do it, we'd like to see if you can get into them and interview some workers and so forth. And so I took them up on that, and most of the mills were very cooperative, and I could go right into the mill and talk to the workers on the floor. Very interesting summer. And in fact, it went on into the next summer a little bit because I was exploring some North Carolina mills, but I went to every textile mill in South Carolina that summer.
What was the biggest takeaway from working for Ralph Nader and making those interviews there?
I think the biggest takeaway was how hard these folks worked in the textile mills, especially the shift workers. And at that time, brown lung disease had been recognized in England for 50 or 60 years, but it was not recognized in the United States. Black lung disease that coal miners get was recognized as a workman's compensation injury or illness, but brown lung disease wasn't. And that's what I was interested in. The textile mills were very cooperative, actually. In fact, there was I'll let you go on with the question.
I'm actually interested in how the story turned out. Was brown lung disease eventually recognized as a result of your efforts?
Yes, as a result of a lot of effort. You know, they were looking at those all over the country, but textiles were very prevalent in the South. And some years later, it became a compensable disease.
I actually had never heard of brown lung disease, and I would never have thought that working in a textile mill would have been dangerous. Now, are we talking about people who are actually making fabric there, and that's where this occurs, or is this people who work with fabric and are making clothes, for example?
Well, it's called bisonosis is the name for it, and it's earlier in the process. The problem is when they cut open the cotton bale and the cotton fiber and dust that comes out of the cotton bale. That's where bisonosis. Those that are running the weaving machines or whatever they call them, it's not there. It's where the bales come in and they're cut open. And that's what my grandfather did, coincidentally. And that's why he has had vivid memories of his coming home from the mill every day, just covered in cotton dust. In fact, he had an air compressor out behind the house, and he'd blow all the cotton dust off of himself before he came in the house. It was a rule that my grandmother had.
So the dust that we're talking about is the dirt from the field that was also on the cotton. They're opening the bales before the cotton is washed and actually spun and turned into fabric.
Right. I don't know that it was the dirt. I think it was the particles from the cotton and the seed, because after you cut it open, it's got to be separated and refined a little bit before you can do anything with it. Or polished, I should say.
Now, you said you went to law school. Where did you go to law school?
Wake Forest University in Winston-Salem, North Carolina.
And why the FCC? I mean, was the FCC recruiting at your law school in those days? How did you think that you might want to work for them?
They were recruiting. I was still very interested in amateur radio and still active as much as I could be to be in school. I didn't have any equipment at law school, but I would come home every couple of weekends or four or five weekends to South Carolina where my equipment was set up, and I would get on, make a few contacts. And they came through colleges down there recruiting, and I decided to just to see what it was all about. And at that time, cable was really big, really about to explode. Also, the land mobile industry was paging, two-way radio, and then later on, trunking system. So it looked like it'd be very interesting, and I got to travel a lot. Our job was to help the small business and figure out how in the world to navigate through the regulation. And I always liked that because I saw a lot of tiny companies become real big companies, and I just stayed year after year. I had good bosses, good cases, and good experiences. I really liked it.
I actually got my start in land mobile in the 70s. In the late 70s, the 800 megahertz band was opening up. I think I've said this maybe the last few weeks on the QSO Today podcast that I remember that we weren't even sure that 800 megahertz would work for land mobile. It was like this experiment that was beginning to happen. How did that look at the FCC when these new bands were opening up and this idea of trunked radio was starting? What was your role in that, and how did it look from your perspective?
Well, it looked like it had great potential in the cities. It just exploded, as you said, and we saw a lot of small companies, a lot of mom-and-pop operations that were doing two-way paging get into 800 megahertz. After a while, a number of companies would file for additional channels claiming that they had a certain number of mobiles. And I don't remember the exact numbers, but if you had a certain number of customers, you could get 5 channels. If you had a certain number, you could get 10 channels or 15. It became apparent that some of these companies could not possibly really have the number of customers that would justify that many channels. But having more channels gave them a leg up on the competitors. So my first land mobile job was to look at the loading of the 13 major cities in the U.S. and take back channels where loading had been doctored up or falsified. For example, if you're in a city and you're looking at one of the land mobile licensees in the trunk system and they show 175 mobiles to a florist company, you know something's wrong because there's probably not a city in America, maybe New York City or Los Angeles, that has 175 florist trucks running around. So we audited those and got back a lot of the channels to give to smaller businesses who couldn't get channels because they were all taken. So we helped to balance out the market, so to speak.
I seem to think that the FCC changed or evolved about this time, maybe when cellular and PCS started, where spectrum was then being sold at auction. I don't recall in the land mobile industry that you had to pay a lot for a license.
No, you didn't.
To have UHF channels or even trunk channels, but it seemed to me that somehow the FCC changed over that period as the big players came in.
Well, what happened was it didn't cost much to get a license, but what we found was somebody would get a license and we noticed it was quickly sold or transferred or assigned, I guess is the correct term. And we started seeing some of these cases and they were getting vast amounts of money for this. And so the idea came up, well, if they're going to get the channels just to sell them for the highest bidder, then maybe the FCC should do that and just auction them off in the first place so the money goes to the taxpayers, you know, into the treasury. So that was the impetus behind auction. So many people were getting a 5-channel block and immediately reselling it. All we were doing was granting these channels to resellers. And so that led to auctions, which seemed like a very ridiculous idea at the time. I remember people laughing at it, but of course auctions were the big thing and that's how they got assigned later on.
Tens of millions of dollars were raised by the FCC, weren't they, from these spectrum auctions, first with these trunk channels, but then later with PCS and cellular?
Yeah, there's been hundreds of millions of dollars raised through those auctions.
And how did that impact the FCC? It seems like as that was happening, the FCC was getting smaller.
Over the years, yeah, the FCC was getting smaller, but the auctions, they had some very smart people handling the auction process, which was computerized after it got started. So the auctions were a great success. The whole process just worked. At the same time, though, you started getting pressures to reduce the size of government. So at the same time, the FCC was getting smaller. Now, it could get smaller in the licensing area because that was automated. Auctions were more or less automated. But in recent years, you've seen it get smaller in the enforcement area, which is not a good development.
This is a wrap on this first excerpt of Eric Guth for Z1UG's 2020 interview with Riley Hollingsworth, K4ZDH, Special Counsel for Amateur Radio Enforcement with the FCC. We'll bring you our second excerpt from that interview next time. This concludes Classic Rain Hamcast number 25. Copyright 1987-2020 Rain. All rights reserved. We ask that if you transmit this hamcast, please do so in its entirety. Classic Rain Hamcast 26 will post August 22, 2020. I'm Will Rogers, K5WLR. Keep on hamming!